break on through. It's time to recognize, realize you're the only one I need. Step on up, step into your greatness.
I see that things are beginning to go nuts, even before the storm is really right here. That's Keb Moe, or Kevin Moore, before he made his life simple with Let Your Light Shine. It's from his 2004 album, Keep It Simple. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. And a program, we're following up on a couple of things. The weather forecasters are saying, yep, it looks like we will be smack in the crosshairs of the newest storm. And it's coming our way after pummeling Puerto Rico and other islands. It will be here in South Florida, packing winds that have not been seen in almost 100 years. The lower part of Florida, the Keys, they have already been evacuated by order of the governor. And all of the counties in Florida are now currently under great watch. They expect that the storm will really wreak havoc. But, you know, people say these things, but at the same time, you cannot ignore this. These are warnings. All of the forecasters are worried about the ferocity of the wind, and they are certain, or fairly certain, that this hurricane, Hurricane Irma, will be very, very devastating to Florida. Now, what does that mean for us? It means that we sit tight, we pack up in a bag, something I can grab and run if I have to. But what is of greatest concern is that there would be so much turbulence in the air. And I don't know that that would sustain a good program. Because these winds, as they say, are packing really, really great force. So there will be disturbances, and in some places they expect that the lines will be down and we will have major interruptions in electricity. Where I am, we normally have problems with electricity anyway. So imagine with this storm coming close or dead on to Central Florida, we certainly will get a lot of that. So it's up in the air whether I'll be live tomorrow and Friday. So tune in just the same and we'll see where we go. Okay? It's a little fluid, I know, but in the last couple of days and in the days to come, the big day that they are really watching would be Friday, Thursday and Friday. That's when the eye of the storm is supposed to be either very, very close to South Florida or actually on South Florida. So there's a lot of concern about the storm. And although in the past years, people have issued similar warnings, practically every single forecaster is saying, do not play around with this storm. It is packing quite a punch, and we are certain that there will be some serious devastation with these ferocious winds and rain. So I'm taking it very seriously. In my complex here, we're all organizing to make sure that everybody has water and so forth. So this is not a joke storm. It is a real serious storm. The last measurements of wind was like almost 180 miles an hour, and they expect that to go higher. So we're going to be bracing for some action, and we are hoping that everybody would be safe and take the appropriate measures by following the directions that we have. And right now, the directions we have, although some places already have been evacuated, the directions that we have a little bit further north for the time being, assemble all the necessities that you might need, like, you know, flashlights and that kind of thing, and canned goods and water, and to check in with the weather service every, like, 10, 15 minutes. But in the meantime, you know, we are not getting frantic. We're just hoping that we will weather the storm and come through in decent shape. All right. Well, that's one kind of storm that is raging. Another storm that is raging is of a political nature, and it's one of our favorite people, Hillary Rodham Clinton. She is skipping across the country to promote and sell her recently released book, What Happened? That's the name of the book. That's not the question she's asking. It's the answers that she's trying to give from her perspective about this question. It just wouldn't die. It should die by now. And what happened is the question to what happened in the 2016 presidential race that caused her to lose it when she was to win. She was ordained by God to win the race, and she's very, very upset. She thinks that this new tour that she's about to begin will certainly increase her political currency within the Democratic Party and even outside of it, because we have inclinations that she is thinking of another run, but she's not saying. And it's one of those things. I don't know if I'm running again, but I need you to beg me just the same. And what is also happening is that there appears to be an effort on her part in building sympathy, in building or rebuilding some kind of her lost political platform, that by the time the authorities get around to prosecuting her, they would first have to encounter the wrath of the public. So that's where we're going today. And I say we because I'm joined by one of the people who has had the greatest authority on matters Clinton and Clinton Foundation. He's Charles Ortel. Hello, Charles. Good to have you with us today.
Hey, you, Trice. You have everything battened down there?
I'm trying. And at some point, you know, I'm just going to leave it all alone and go to sleep if I can.
Oh, good. Be safe.
Yeah, we're trying to do that. My neighbors and I, we're really a good crew, and we're looking out for each other here. So excellent. What do you think of this new tactic of causing all of this friction and being, I think, you know, just like a person, irritant? Now she's blaming openly and sarcastically blaming and attacking Sanders for causing her the win. What do you think is going on here?
Well, you know, it's really in some ways very sad to see. I remember many years ago when I was living upstate, I was driving my car around getting ready to pick up my daughter from school. And I had the top 40 station on, and this song came on by you probably know of this musician Shaggy. The song "It Wasn't Me," and I nearly crashed the car. I was laughing so hard. I mean, this is another episode of "It Wasn't Me." I mean, we have to look at what happened. I mean, the hurricane that happened last year was Donald Trump. That hurricane took apart the establishment Republicans. It did so with spending less money, defying all the conventional norms to get the primary nomination in face of numerous scandals that didn't seem to stop the course of that hurricane from gaining the general election. Position as president candidate for the Republicans. While on the other side, you know, in your intro, I mean, Hillary Clinton is behaving as, you know, I paid for this election in 2016. I should be president. it's silliness. When we go and we look back at the performance in the primaries, when we contrast, forget Donald Trump's crowds, but I personally experienced Bernie Sanders' Washington Square Park crowd on one cold day. I want to say it was in April-ish. I think it was April. 2016, and the crowd was incredible, not only for its size, not only for its patience in waiting for the whole security matters to come together. You know, you had to get there and wait outside with no food, no nothing for like 2 or 3 hours before the first speakers came, and then ultimately he came many, many hours after we got there. And that crowd, you know, young, old, white, black, Hispanic, straight, gay, you name it, it didn't get in the fights. There were no altercations. There was no shouting. There was no garbage. There was no trash talk, except when Hillary Clinton's name came up. And, you know, there really was, I think, for Bernie, rightly or wrongly, a movement. Whereas you contrast that with Hillary's crowds, those that were not staged were disappointingly small. After all, for, you know, that own reboot at Welfare Island, where, you know, after the first announcement didn't take hold, she tried again, and she couldn't even fill up a venue with her own supporters on I believe it was, you know, nice weather and everything else. And beyond that, what did she stand for? You know, what positive things did Hillary Clinton stand for? And in contrast, I mean, to say that to go after Bernie Sanders because, quote, he made the conditions possible for Donald Trump to use the crooked Hillary approach. I mean, I don't think Bernie Sanders had much to do with Whitewater or any of the ensuing many scandals, let alone the torrid tales of the Clinton Foundation. And in fact, at crucial moments in the debate, Bernie Sanders, if you remember, a moderator at one debate brought up the issue of the emails, and Bernie said, you know, I don't think I want to spend any time on those damn emails. I mean, he was pretty gracious in not basically rounding on that, and all the false filings and fraudulent filings and fraudulent fundraising and overstated claims made by Hillary Clinton. He didn't really go after her as hard as, you know, I would imagine somebody else might. And I don't think what America is waiting for, I only speak as one American, I'm looking for the most qualified person who can assemble a team to try to rewrite the ship of state. I care not whether the person is male, female, white, black. I look at a pattern of accomplishments, you know, which would give me reason credibly to believe that the next team can rewrite the ship of state. And I do certainly am not going to vote for somebody because it's their time. And that's what seems to be the approach she's been taking.
Well, whether she is taking this approach for that, we know for sure there are other reasons that she needs as much distraction. She needs to deploy as much distraction as possible because she is in, and her husband Bill and possibly her daughter Chelsea, they're all in quite a soup, and the nooses are being readied, not just here in the United States, it seems, but overseas as well. And the crux of their attention is, in fact, the Clinton Foundation. So it's a good idea to have a very enthusiastic book sale. She beats up Donald Trump. She beats up the person who toured or attempted to tour the country to support her, and he got what he deserved, and that is Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders really betrayed his movement, I think, by finally allying himself and his movement with Hillary Clinton and basically volunteering for the Democratic Party's role of ambassador-in-chief. He was very confused about what the heck he was doing and still is. He hasn't really explained himself. He hasn't explained this puzzling alliance with the Democratic Party. And he hasn't spoken to his political base about, you know, his version of the book's title, What Happened. So I have no mercy for Bernie, really, because I thought that he had seen things very clearly, that he was being used, that Hillary and the Democratic Party were out because they hadn't done any work. They didn't have any money. All that when Hillary left, you know, after that, the way things turned out, and we didn't see her and so forth for a while, that was refreshing, but it didn't last long. And she still needs to answer the questions, and the party leadership was just patently corrupt. We saw what they did in Florida to legally drum up votes for her, and it failed, and it was openly detected. But beyond all of that, she also didn't see herself as a Democrat having any other duties to other members of the party or to the party itself, which is to rebuild this party and to help refund the party, because a lot of the party's funds went to support her, the understanding being that suddenly Hillary Clinton is the lead dog in this race, and if she wins, she's going to bring a whole lot of people behind her. That absolutely did not happen. So what are these nooses that are tying, getting a little tighter around the Clintons' necks?
Sure. Well, there's an array of them. I know that numerous foreign governments have given, all told, many hundreds of millions of dollars they thought was going to a validly organized Clinton Foundation that they thought was allowed to pursue the tax-exempt purposes that sound important, like fighting HIV/AIDS or climate change or other international issues. And I believe many of these governments realized prior to the election that the Clinton Foundation was, in fact, a fraud. And they were in a difficult position prior to the election because had Hillary won, there was probably no way they could, you know, coax the United States to do the right thing and punish the Clintons, her husband and her daughter, and, you know, arguably even herself for some of these transactions. That would be a tough road to hoe. So to everyone's shock, the entire punditry, and, you know, many observers who thought they knew what was going on, she lost. And it's taken a little while to come to terms with that. And people, obviously, she hasn't come to terms with that. Many of her ardent supporters haven't come to terms with that. But governments have started to see the fact that, you know, this was a fraud, and it was an egregious fraud. And so there are many of the governments, clearly, that gave extraordinary amounts of money towards the Clintons, like the Clintons. So it takes a fair amount of, changing of one's course to be able to say, I made a huge mistake here, and now I need my money back. So you take a country like Australia. Australia still has politicians who like the Clintons. But in other countries, in France, in Norway, in the UK, in Ireland, who knows what's going on now in Korea, there are many other foreign countries that have sent large sums of money, and the chief of which is France. France, all told, sent about $450 million towards the Clinton Foundation in the form of annual donations. They even made advances before year-end 2009 against future commitments to the Clintons to, in theory, fight HIV/AIDS at a time when the Clinton Foundation HIV/AIDS initiative didn't actually exist, had been disciplined, had been caught for diverting money. And somehow this organization we've talked about, Switzerland, called Unitaid, which was the catchment vehicle for contributions from a number of governments and from the Gates Foundation, somehow the bright bulbs at Unitaid either knew there was a fraud and were participating in getting backhanders of the flows. You know, that is to say, they would make a donation to the Clinton Foundation and the Clinton Foundation would leak money back to them. You know, or they were basically just incredibly stupid, in which case, why should they have any money to begin with? So there's a great article. There's a friend of mine who I know has some say he's controversial, but I have found him now over 10 years of knowing him to be a very thoughtful, fair-minded person, Jerry Corsi, particularly when it comes to matters of financial and political fraud. And he has a piece on Alex Jones today on this, talking about how the French government and possibly the UK government may be moved here to have a Spike Lee moment and do the right thing and you know, expose this, reveal to the public what representations these governments and Unitaid were told by the Clintons, reveal to the public what steps they may have taken to try to get their money back, if any. And now that it does appear as if this may come all crashing down, move aggressively in their home countries and possibly here in the United States, not only against the Clintons and the trustees, but against the major donors like the Gates Foundation and the Rockefeller Foundation and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and other large foundations that for years have given massive sums to this set of frauds, playing along for who knows what reason. So, yes, I would like to say that the legal machinery is tightening. And what's very different here, I would just hasten to add for those who've been following this is not like a corporate fraud. This is not like even a political scandal alone. In a charity fraud, there are very, very strict rules. And so that's why Corinne Brown, for $800,000, former representative down in Florida, Corinne Brown, was convicted recently of almost 20 federal counts, I think many of them are felony counts, and faces, you know, potentially, you know, a very long prison sentence, even though she's 70. And even though she has, in quotes, served this country for a decade or more, over a small matter, $800,000, she's already been convicted, and her trial, she made an attempt to have a different trial. That's thrown out. She will be sentenced as soon as by November. And, you know, America and the world faces a spectacle of this connected set of cronies, the Clintons. You know, now she's on an excuse tour. She's got a... through her powerful connection, she'll be on Jane Pauley on CBS on Sunday, I believe, you know, promoting this book, this angry attack at all of her enemies. She gets to do stuff like this. Corinne Brown doesn't. And the scale of the Clinton Foundation frauds is, you know, literally thousands of times as big as the Corinne Brown scandal. And in addition, you know, in the scale, the Clinton Foundation thing, one nuance we haven't really addressed as much as we need to is that in November of 2013, after the New York Times raised the heat on the Clinton Foundation, in the dead of night, the Clintons changed the governance of their foundation to make them, the family, Bill, Hillary, and Chelsea, super voting directors, basically in charge of this entity. You're not allowed to do that by law of a public charity. You can't convert a public charity into a family holding company and gut the governance procedures, and then hide the fact that you did that from the state and foreign authorities. Yet that is exactly what they did do, and that is a matter now of public record. They've been dribbling out after the election in certain states these filings that conclusively show exactly what happened. At first, they did this in November 2013, and then in September 2015, which would be 5 months after Hillary announced for president, they took Hillary's name off as one of these three super voting directors. And as Stuart Dean, a friend of mine is a very skilled lawyer, points out, not only is this not a validly organized charity, but the way in which they ran roughshod over basic governance procedures calls into question whether this is even a validly organized nonprofit corporation to begin with, meaning that if it isn't, none of the directors or executives or even the agents would have any kind of hope of having indemnity for these many crimes of operating charities illegal in multiple U.S. and foreign jurisdictions, as well as soliciting funds illegally around the world. So, you know, you're right. The real hurricane bearing down on the United States political establishment is the one targeting the Clintons. And, you know, I think it's bearing down with full force. I hope, you know, I'm not making light of what's going on in Florida or in the Caribbean now. These are terrible, terrifying events. I hope people are safe. But the people who chose to live down in the path of the hurricane are different than these Clintons. They didn't merely choose to live here now in New York. They chose to break the law for 20 years, boldly, around the world, soliciting vast sums, going from being broke, dead broke, to now being worth who knows how much on paper. So, yeah, there's a big drama playing out beyond this book and the poor choice of the title, the poor choice of its release date, 5 years after Benghazi, a year after the episode where she, you know, fainted. The last 9/11 remembrance, 5 days after this event concerning the book of her pastor, which is now, I understand, been pulled, even though there's a book event scheduled tomorrow, I believe.
Manhattan.
She's made a lot of bad choices.
Well, she made a lot of bad choices, but we have to say, too, how corrupt the system was to have consistently accommodated, and they had to have known that the Clintons were a corrupt couple and had broken the laws, even the laws of the party. They did nothing. They tolerated her. They did everything possible to direct as much money to her campaign because she was a sure bet. Others could make a claim, I think, that their campaigns suffered because she swallowed up all of the oxygen in the room. Then she went at Bernie Sanders with such vigor, and still he turned around and said, well, you know, basically he looked around and there was nothing happening. The party was so fractured. It had no leadership, no coherent policy. It couldn't put up a fight, and in a way, it conceded to trade off. They would turn a blind eye to the Clintons' shenanigans, and in return, they'll play ball and hope that, you know, it works out. So the party itself, they drew the party into this vortex of corruption out of which the party still hasn't gotten out of. So
yeah,
one of the things that I would say, too, is, you know, we can't sever the important ties between the Clintons and the absolute destruction and deterioration of the Democratic Party. And that goes all the way from Clinton to Obama, and even now.
What do you think? It is sad. And I say that, you know, I was more inclined to be a Republican. I dislike both parties. I have an ancestor who knows, he might have been president of the United States. He ran for Congress as a Democrat in Montana. I have another ancestor in 1904. I have another ancestor who was the mayor of Springfield, Illinois, from 1846 to 1849, and went out to California and had a hand in a small hand in founding the Democratic Party out in California. So I have affection for the Democratic Party, and it is, I'd like to see two strong parties, each with different perspectives on important issues. I'd like to see them both be effective. And through that kind of tension, oftentimes, the best ideas do result when people of good feeling get together. But, you know, when I look at the 2015-16 primary system, what disgusts me, if you contrast the Republican process with the Democratic process, I mean, you got to admit, we have to admit that the Republican process may dislike all 17 candidates, but there was one hell of a free-for-all where, you know, everybody went at it, and we can debate whether the best man was left standing, but somebody won. In the case of the Democratic primaries, in hindsight, and even at the time, it sure looks to me as if the Clintons maneuvered the whole system, gamed it, you know, pretended that Bernie would have a shot, but with the, you know, the superdelegate rules that gave so many superdelegates to Hillary right away, and then the inside baseball game that Hillary played, you know, apparently getting debate questions in advance and having all these surrogates in a place to influence all the public opinion. Her role is obviously the non-neutral Deborah Wasserman Schultz, who favored Hillary over all other comers. And then, of course, you know, the scandal that George Webb and Jason Goodman and Luke Rosiak at the Daily Caller and you, Therese, have been talking about the Awan scandal, you know, the degree to which this Pakistani group may have infiltrated the establishment under Deborah Wasserman Schultz and numerous other Congress people in this electoral process. All of this disgusts me. The degree to which, you know, the system appears to be rigged so that the big money behind the system, and it's not simply capitalist money, it's labor union money, it's, you know, sadly even it shouldn't be, but there's foreign money meddling in this. And the individual politicians, even and perhaps especially the rich ones, don't really have the wherewithal to stave off these vested special interests. So what happens? We manufacture false debates to divide the people from amongst ourselves so that we don't come together and confront problems we could face commonly. I mean, one common problem that where I disagree with my rich Republican friends is that because there is a global labor glut, because artificial intelligence and technology are getting ever more powerful, you know, minute by minute, all human labor is under threat. So all of us, especially all of us here in the United States who are on world scale are paid so highly, we're all under threat. And we ought to stop pretending as if, you know, there isn't something badly wrong with, I'm sorry to pick on you, Jeff Immelt at GE, but a guy who takes control of a company when the stock's trading at 40 and then runs it into the ground, again, a difficult hand was given to him over 16 years, and the stock's at 25, and he gets half a billion to $1 billion. The average human being looks at that, even myself, you know, with a lot of experience in investing, I look at that and I say, it's outrageous. You know, why should an executive who ran a company into the ground walk away with that kind of dough when the average American family finds a hard time in a rural area getting by in $75,000, let alone $100,000. This guy's walking away with half a billion for that. And we see this type, that type of inequality, you know, where the line worker has to work hard and the frontline teacher and everybody has to make sure that they're really working nowadays 24/7 to keep their job. And you get these cronies, the Clintons included, and, you know, Immelt and others, who appear to do very little. They swan around in private jets, fancy hotel suites, you know, have legions of staff people taking care of them, whether they're big politicians or big corporate types. And, you know, they don't seem to ever lose. I mean, Hillary has basically done two gigantic swan dives into pavement in 2008 and 2016. And Bill and Hillary are worth, some say, $200 million or more. Does that seem fair? You know, and so there are elements on the right and the left. We can look at that together and say, there's something wrong with that system. If you're going to let people swing for the fences, they should only collect the big paychecks when they perform, not whether they win or lose, and especially not when the companies or peoples they lead lose. They shouldn't win. So that's an area. The question of, you know, the deep state, and, you know, I actually think one of the negatives after September 11th is that people across the spectrum have accepted this premise that, you know, these people who work in the shadows should be given unlimited latitude to do whatever they want with unlimited funds, and also be given the ability to, you know, investigate all of us surreptitiously. And, you know, we aren't safer today in 2017 than we were in 2001. And, you know, so that whole area of how the deep state has exploded, how the military-industrial complex is or is not regulated, that's an area where actually across the political spectrum you'll find, I think, people you might think are conservative and people you might think are, in quotes, progressive, working together on the question of education. You know, why we see in so many parts of our lives costs plummeting, for example, transportation, telecommunications. Why should the cost of education continue soaring? You know, why should it cost so much to go to one of these top universities? Why should the professors make so much money and have tenure and have the ability to, on the side, do all these fancy projects, not really actually teach or care that the students are doing well? That's another area. So those are three areas, one on the right and on the left. You know, I actually think what good-meaning people, good-hearted people could admit we have problems and we can get together and solve them no matter what our parties are. Hillary wasn't talking like that. Hillary was on the prowl for another $225,000 half-an-hour speech. I mean, that's her game, you know, or some inside sweetheart deal for her and Bill, Lloyd Education, $18 million, five-year contract for part-time work. You know, she's playing the crony system like never before. And sadly, on Bernie, you know, I fear there's a lot of there when it comes to this whole issue of his wife and this college that she was president of and may have, you know, the college may have lied on a loan application and now the college is no more. And, you know, the Sanders are fine. Thank you very much. They have three homes. You know, I think the average American person is sick of this bunk. And we want to see, we don't want to see a lot of talk through the election season. We don't want to see a lot of promises. We have our own problems. They're vexing. We fix them. We make sacrifices and we fix them. Why does Washington, D.C. get to work as infrequently as it work? And why can, you know, why can't they seem to get anything done? The problems, it's, we're not talking about Albert Einstein level problems. We're talking about, you know, when you spend more money than you have a problem. When you spend $6.5 trillion a year on government, you are wasting money for sure. When you award no-bid contracts to cronies and political donors, you have all the ingredients you need for corruption. You know, there's some very obvious problems. I think those problems were the ones that got the crowds out for Bernie. I think in the healthcare system, another whole big set of problems. You know, all of this debate has been falsely placed upon insurance. We have an insurance problem, but what we really have is a healthcare problem. The cost of healthcare.
What we really have is we have a former president, we have a former secretary of state who also was a former senator, a U.S. senator, and a former candidate twice for the presidency, linked to some of the most outrageous kinds of corruption I've seen in a long time. But, you know, they're walking around and having lunch dates and, you know, living the life, a very nice life, seemingly assured that nothing is going to happen to them. The constituencies that normally would be concerned if they were Republicans, you would have all kinds of, you know, party lawsuits being filed. You'd have people coming out and condemning this, not just the missing money, and that is significant. I can't get over the fact that people, for example, the people who are fighting genocide and so forth, have no link. They make no link between this AIDS program that they were running with a number of people who might have died from the bogus drugs that they were distributing with a criminally convicted pharmaceutical company all over Africa. And as their plan written down in a memo. They proudly said that they were going to go after the market in the Caribbean and more markets in Africa with this bogus drug program. And only one congressperson so far seems very perturbed about this. I am perturbed about this because you're messing around in my part of the world. And you're getting away with what I would classify as genocide.
Yeah.
You have people who are very, very sick, and you're playing with their lives, saying, well, your charity is dedicated to doing good works, and you're distributing these bogus drugs that have been proven in courts of law as being bogus.
Yeah.
And you come before the public like, a saint. Nobody's standing up. So is the philanthropic world also what? What is accounting for their silence?
Well, I think, this, when it's a gigantic problem and you've got to admit that you've been wrong for a long time, I understand human nature a little bit, about this. I can understand there'd be some reluctance. But, you raise, as usual, some great points. I think we should drill into them a little bit. One is that when the subject of charity comes up, there is an on-point case. I think it's Federated Pharmacies or something like that versus the tax commissioner. It's an on-point case that says it is not charity to promote the distribution of drugs at a profit. That is not charity. And that's exactly what Bill Clinton admits in giving his book. Elton John confirms it in Elton John's book, that Bill Clinton's pitch on getting behind Ranbaxy and getting behind this HIV/AIDS thing, he sold it as a business opportunity. And Elton John, basically reacted sort of not really, I don't think, thinking it through all that carefully. He thought it was, well, isn't Bill smart? He's looking at this very professionally in a business-like fashion. Bill's argument was, you're missing out on the potential to sell these drugs, guys. We have the capability, there's a distinction between HIV and AIDS. HIV is the precursor for AIDS. We do have the ability and have had the ability to extend lifetimes well beyond where they used to be once you are diagnosed with HIV. And Bill's argument was, look, if you just allow these people to get sick and die, you won't be able to sell them these life-extending drugs, for 10, 20, 30 years the way you could if you lowered your prices. So you're missing out on a business opportunity was basically his argument. And just on the strength of that one alone, I disqualify the charity. That is not charitable to go to these Indian generic companies who didn't have a foothold at the time on the market, at the time that Bill did this with Ira Magaziner, and sell this to the Indians as a way to promote their business. And not really tell the truth, as you're required to, about the fact that in October of 2003, in the name of the Clinton Foundation, they'd signed an agreement with at least one company, Ranbaxy, to promote the sale of these products. It's in Ranbaxy's annual report. They brag about one of the accomplishments in October 2003. I think their year ended April 2004 or March 2004, I forget which. So their year is a slightly different thing. But the annual report's online. There's a picture of Bill Clinton in it. There's, bragging about the terms of this agreement. A charity is not allowed to be engaged in business development for a company. You're just not allowed to do that. And that's what he did. And if you're going to engage in promotion of products, put your stamp of approval on some products, you better make sure they work. In October of 2003, it is a settled fact that no Ranbaxy product had been ever tested by a reliable third party. So at the time they signed this agreement, they didn't even know if the goods were any good, drugs were any good, and unfortunately they weren't. So that's one thing. This was a business development exercise, not a charity. And as you rightly point out, it is dangerous stuff to be distributing these drugs, and I'll try to do this quickly, but the Corsi article today, which is really worth reading, makes the important distinction that the drugs that Unitaid was buying through the Clinton Foundation were targeting children. children with HIV/AIDS. Now, you know, by 2006-07, in that time frame, technologies had moved along and knowledge had moved along to prevent the transmission of HIV from mother to child. So incidents of children having HIV, regrettably, children are raped and exposed to this kind of stuff. But I'm not sure I buy the argument of the numbers that, you know, the Clintons claim may have had this. And I would note that the medical experts I consult say it is a dangerous thing to go to a child and give them this medicine if they don't, in fact, have HIV/AIDS. And the test kits used to test for this in Africa, in the Caribbean, in the poor parts of Asia, are just not as good as those that we would use in the West. So it is quite possible that they may have given this medicine to kids who didn't have HIV. And the side effects, Celia Farber wrote a wonderful story, a sad story, a poignant story for Harper's, I think in 2006, about an adult woman who was misdiagnosed with HIV and died a grisly death. And it was in Harper's. Her name is Celia, C-E-L-I-A, Farber, F-A-R-B-E-R. Look it up. You'll see what I'm talking about. The types of drugs that, you know, some of these drugs have worked, but sadly, all drugs have side effects. And some of these drugs have had horrific side effects, killing people. And, you know, this system, this overall Clinton HIV/AIDS initiative was never really directed. Still today is not directed by people who've owned up to their whole history, by people who have, you know, deep training, on-the-ground training, who are full-time engaged in figuring out how to do this properly, as is evident from the track record. So,
but they had somebody overseeing this program. She just happened to be a saleswoman for Caterpillar Tractors.
Yeah, that was... Ruby Zhang, I think you're talking about. That's the one who is more focused, I think, on the climate change issues. But in the HIV/AIDS initiative, it was Ira Magaziner, who does not have a medical credential, though he was a Rhodes scholar. I like to refer to those people as Rhodes scholars. But he did not have any medical training, and yet they had advisors. But having advisors is very different than having full-time, highly experienced people directed by professionals that they never have had.
What's preventing a public inquisition insofar as the system that should be taking care of this in a serious way, proceeding with, you know, looking into documents, presenting documents, and coming to some kind of a finding? If it is taking this long, and even so, in the interest of the public input in a case like this, why couldn't the public take a piece of this case and conduct a public inquisition or inquiry?
It's a great question, Yatrice. Some of that, I think, is in progress. I mean, we do know that... the IRS still has not revealed whether they're going to press forward, as I believe they should, with investigations. We don't know what's going on with these four FBI field office investigations. We don't yet know how many foreign governments are doing this. We do know that a lot of world leaders will be in New York shortly. And I can tell you there are more revelations coming concerning this matter that, you know, I've been working on this now, thanks to you and with others, for over 2 years. There's a lot of information I have not yet shared. I'm waiting for the right time. I'm waiting to see whether, you know, our own Justice Department, our own people will do the right thing. Step up to the bat. You know, it's possible to have rogue charities. This is one of them. This is a diabolical set of them. And these are being run, in quotes, by people who should know better. They've been trying to get all kinds of credit. One of them just, you know, wanted to be president of the United States, and it's like a spoiled brat is behaving that she's not responsible for her crushing defeat because she is responsible. So I think, you know, the public has to continue to get more engaged. I appreciate your giving me this platform. We have to raise our collective voices, and we have to demand that, you know, when people run a charity as Robin Hood in reverse, stealing from the poor to give to themselves and the rich cronies, they should be punished severely.
There's no question about that in my mind. And the constant attacks that they wage in the process in the developing world, in Africa, in the Caribbean, they have done incredible damage. The abuse of power that occurred here, using their powers in the United States to go abroad and create havoc in people's lives. And there is no accountability for the deaths as well. That drug program, to me, is a genocidal program. You're giving people supposedly drugs that would help them or improve their condition, and you know that these are bogus drugs, watered down drugs, diluted drugs. You have no records. You have no personnel to supervise a massive undertaking like this. You're playing around with people's health, you know, and, well, they're dispensable. And they go to these countries with the assurance that they'll be dealing with corrupt leaders there. So it's, you know, thieves and corrupt people dealing with other thieves and corrupt people. And I am just outraged about it, that we should allow a former president, his wife and his daughter, and a collection of miscreant friends to put together a money-making machine that could possibly, they're taking gambles with other people's lives. I think that is outrageous. So we need to look forward. When the United Nations meetings occur next week in New York, it would be a good time to get to meet people who understand a thing or two about the way the Clintons conduct business through their foundation. Certainly, we ought to find where the money went, because along with the fact that they delivered these bogus drugs and services, there's a lot of money that nobody has seen, and we would like to know where it went. But I want to thank you for joining us today and adding more light. This is a great development in the sense that, you know, it opens up for public understanding and inspection. It opens up new chambers in this labyrinth that need to be looked at very carefully and need to be vigorously prosecuted. So thanks so much for being with us today, and thanks for your work. I mean, you're a godsend. You are meticulous. This is why you brought down General Electric and those companies who were overvaluing their stocks, and you caught them. So you have an eye for detail that should scare the living daylights out of everybody.
Well, thank you, Beatrice, for this opportunity. And you know, this is for, I think, a good cause. There are a lot of great people in charity land, and they deserve to be sure that, you know, charities are properly regulated. And when somebody like these Clintons go around the world literally raising money from foreign governments, diverting it and doing these kind of things, it's time for some rough justice.
Yes, indeedy. Thanks again for being with us. So I'm going to explain, for me, tomorrow is going to be kind of iffy because we don't know how things are developing here. Everybody is a minute-by-minute scenario, and certainly by Friday it's going to be really, really a test of wills. So I'll keep you posted, and in the meantime, just, you know, go with the flow. Nothing to get over worried about. I think where I am is going to be relatively safe. And we just have to huddle together. I have great, great neighbors. And now I understand why the landscapers were cutting all those tree limbs last week and causing a headache. But We'll see how it works, minute by minute, hour by hour, over the next couple of days. Stay tuned. Coming up next, Global Alert News with Dane Wigington. And welcome. I am going to listen today as well. We'll see each other tomorrow, maybe. Bye-bye.
Come on, let your light.